Even when Tesla had his old laboratories on South Main Street, now West Broadway, in New York, he had lights which could be picked up and placed in any position anywhere in the laboratory, wherever light happened to be needed at the moment. His lights were merely glass tubes, free from wires and wall fixtures. So the inventor, for many years, enjoyed the fruits of his own inventions, while the public has paid and paid and paid the pipers whoever pipe for more money profits from their outmoded merchandise. The Tesla wireless method for electrical distribution is a gift which the world might have utilized for the past half century had the public demanded it. But an uninformed public is a silent public. The public gets its information largely from newspapers and magazines, radio and TV. These sources are, in turn, controlled and censored by their advertisers and government secret garders. This conditioned public then dictates to its teachers and its preachers, telling them what to teach and what pulpit topics would be most uplifting to the community spirit. Thus the vicious circle whirls round and round like a Sputnik. Even Tesla himself was told off by J.P. Morgan when he explained his world wireless system to the financier. Morgan listened to Tesla describe the glories of his invention, and then the money baron dismissed the whole subject as impractical because, as he pointed out, there would be no way of making money off the people if the people could have as much electricity as they wished by merely putting up a little antenna on their homes, or factories or office buildings. Morgan further reminded Tesla that under the present system the manufacturers of wires, poles, and electrical installation equipment of all kinds, could make fortunes, and in addition, the electricity could be metered and everybody could be charged for every kilowatt they used. Tesla pointed out that electricity was free in the atmosphere, a free gift of God to his people, but such idealism naturally could not penetrate the thinking of a financier. Early in the years when Tesla was draining out his T-car, he called Carr's attention to the same fact. Electricity is free in the atmosphere, a gift of God to his people. Carr agreed with Tesla instantly. But Carr was not a financier, he was merely working as a clerk in a hotel package room. Perhaps therein lies the answer. Part. Why, when Tesla left his sleeping body on the night of January 7, 1943, he did not return to it. The threefold flame which had blazed so brightly in his physical heart for 87 years was withdrawn into his subtle structure. The flowing line of electronic light known as the silver cord, which enters the body at the top of the head and is anchored in the heart, with another branch anchored in the brain, was broken. At once the flow of electronic light ceased. No more pure God substance carrying the energies of the rays entered the physical body through the silver cord. The power which beats the heart of man, the heart of a solar system, and the heart of a cosmos, was withdrawn from the physical. Tesla stood free to enter in full consciousness the realms of unlimited lighted awareness that he had left 87 years earlier, in order that he might walk and talk with men on the planet Earth. During his years in America, Tesla had mentioned to certain persons, among them John J. O'Neill, that he planned to live 130 years. This statement was privately regarded as another bit of eccentricity that could come only from the lips of the genius Tesla. It was understood that Tesla had earlier fixed the period of his stay on Earth at 150 years. He changed the figure shortly after World War I when Prohibition was adopted. Because of his paradoxical statements about the matter at that time, and the unusual circumstances surrounding his pronouncement, his words were interpreted in the usual Earth manner, and it was generally believed that the Prohibition Amendment had somehow shortened his life. However, Tesla was not in any sense a drinking man's, as the term is generally used. Neither was Tesla a hearty eater. It was true that for years and years, immaculately groomed and attired in full dress, he entered the Hotel Waldorf dining room promptly each evening at 8 o'clock. Sitting quietly alone at his reserved table, and dining while he read through several newspapers, until 10 p.m. It was true that in his early days in New York he often gave lavish dinner parties for many guests, taking them afterwards to his laboratories on South Fifth Avenue for an evening's entertainment. There he demonstrated to his guests thrilling electrical feats of such magnitude that men literally felt their hair rising straight up on their astonished heads. Women squealed and giggled and would have swooned except that they did not want to miss an instant of the magic. But Tesla, while the very core and center of these dinner parties, magic evening, and conversation fests, actually ate little food. As the years passed, he was seldom observed eating. Otis Tikar said that during the 3 years that he was being trained by Tesla, he never saw him consume any food. However, prior to Prohibition days, Tesla would occasionally, and after due ceremony, drink a tiny glass of whiskey. He said that it gave him a special type of energy that he could use. Then when Prohibition came, he ordered his last glass of whiskey and made the astonishing statement that Prohibition would shorten his life by 20 years, reducing his time on Earth from 150 to 130 years. In retrospect, it is clear that he was making a direct reference to the future political situation in the United States and to the world situation in general. Prohibition was an early symptom that a sick world was growing sicker. A man of Tesla's caliber was certainly not vitally concerned with a glass of whiskey, per se. In the final analysis, it is also clear that Tesla was using the whiskey as a focus for some sort of transmutation. It is doubtless quite true that the tiny glass of liquid would supply him with a special sort of energy, but only after he had called certain energies into action within the liquid. Tesla's atomic structure was relatively clean, at least during the first 70 or 75 years of his life, or perhaps even longer. Apparently at the close, as he was nearing 87 years, the atoms may have slowed their evolutions somewhat, but at no time did he permit himself to take on an accumulation of astral debris, for remember, Tesla could see the astral filth all about him and took special precautions to avoid it. For many, many years he passed currents of tremendously high voltage and high frequency through his body. His associates and friends were astonished that these experiments proved not only harmless but healthful, and most people thought it was merely a feat of showmanship. It was not, however, but rather something which Tesla had extracted from the ether as a definite construct for his own protection. His atomic structure was normally vibrating at a very high rate, and the vibrations were raised even higher by passing the electric currents through his body tissues. He could not burden such a body with quantities of food intended for the ordinary Earthman. Moreover, the process of transmuting food, already cooked and prepared, would have been too laborious. It would require a useless expenditure of time and energy, but a small glass of distilled alcohol could probably have been acted upon instantly by forces summoned into action by Tesla. The little contemplative ceremony in which Tesla engaged before he finally raised the glass to his lips was probably the transmuting ceremony. It could be performed in public, in any bar, without attracting any attention whatsoever. A better understanding of this action can be arrived at by reading the accounts of experiences which various Earthmen have had while visiting on board spacecraft. All of these contacts agree on one point. When they board the craft, they are handed a beautiful crystal goblet containing a liquid of such delightful flavor and fragrance that it is said to be utterly indescribable. It is non-alcoholic, but when it is consumed, it provides the body with the buoyant, refreshing type of energy which clears the brain and gives the individual a subtle sense of serene awareness, freeing him from any feeling of fear or hostility. Those contacts who have been invited to dine aboard space ships have had some interesting experiences along similar lines. George Van Tassel of Giant Rock, California, author of several books on spaceships and space people, said that he was offered small cubes of substance that resembled ordinary cubes of sugar. But before eating them, he was asked to qualify them with any flavor he desired. If he thought of ice cream while gazing at the cube, it tasted like the most delicious ice cream. If he thought of a juicy steak, it tasted like a juicy steak, and so on. George Adamski, in his book Inside the Spaceships, tells about dining on board a spacecraft and enjoying a wonderful meal of fabulous foods that tasted like the finest meats and vegetables and desserts, But actually the dishes did not seem to fall into any of these categories. Adamski was also treated to a preliminary crystal goblet of the marvelous liquid which has been known down through the ages as Elixir of the Gods. But all of this food and drink served aboard spacecraft is precipitated direct from universal supply. All adepts must be able to practice precipitation. Moreover, during the Aquarian Age, we must all relearn this method which we knew at one time, but which was blotted from our racial memory by the contamination brought in by the laggards. Ascended Master Saint Germain, the adept in charge of our present era, became a man of mystery all through Europe during the 100 years he served humanity after his ascension on May 2, 1684, because no one could understand his powers of precipitation. In his high-frequency ascension body, Saint Germain was permitted by law to mingle with his disciples on the physical plane for an entire century prior to his appointment as Chuan of the Seventh Ray. During this time he was constantly supplied with every good thing, an abundance of money, fabulous jewels, fine clothes, and a whole century of leisure hours in which to teach and train his disciples for the present age. Virtually every disciple who is working with Saint Germain now was called into embodiment during that century to prepare for the present incarnation. It is these disciples who will be able to restore and again anchor the precipitation process on the physical earth plane. Back in the early Lemurian days before the laggards came, and before the world fell into its present state of atheistic materialism, human greed was unknown. In those days, men had never heard of such a preposterous thing as earning a living by the sweat of one's brow. In fact, they were totally unacquainted with sweat. They enjoyed a perfect climate. They did not live in huts or hovels, they lived in the most exquisite surroundings amid an endless globe-encircling garden of trees and grass and flowers prepared under the direction of Amaryllis herself, the goddess of spring. When a family group sat down to dine, the family head, the father, presided at the communion ceremony, for that is what it was. The group prepared to eat of the body of God substance, to drink of the elixir of his circulating energies. In a degraded manner, the communion service practiced by churchianity today is an attempt to produce this ancient Lemurian custom of precipitation. The Lemurian family group, their minds held steady in the light of universal light, joined in the thanksgiving and acceptance ceremony for that which they were about to receive. Instantaneous precipitation followed, with a table bedecked with the finest linens, silver and dishes, and laden with an abundance of food and drink which met their exact nutritive requirements of that particular family. At the close of the meal, the mother performed the next necessary ceremony of etherealization, or returning to universal supply all unused food and drink and all table accessories. This is the key step in the precipitation process. If the etherealization process is not performed in love, and faith and confidence, then the ability to precipitate further supply is withdrawn. In other words, as children of God we are entitled to as much of His abundance as we can use to serve life constructively. If we precipitate food, then we are not privileged to toss the leftovers into the garbage can or store them in the refrigerator. They must be returned to the universal storehouse where the molecules are broken up and the atoms freed for use elsewhere. The depths of depravity reached by the human race can easily be estimated by our one great product: waste. Only Earth people are so arrogant as to speak of waste matter, let alone produce it. There is no waste in the universe. The Father not only knows when the sparrow falls, he also keeps a strict account of each atom, for an atom is a tiny life. The only way to handle so-called waste is to permit it to be returned to the universal storehouse. This storehouse is a reservoir of unqualified electronic substance. In that state it is ready for use by anyone who wishes to qualify it. In recent years the space people have pointed out again and again that it is our excessive waste matter from nuclear fission and fusion that constitutes the greatest threat to our destruction. The bomb explosions are much less harmful than the resulting fallout, and the fallout is even less destructive than the waste accumulated during the manufacturing process. During the last quarter of a century, Ascended Master Saint Germain has been working actively among his disciples, particularly those in the United States, because North America is now the physical beating heart of the world, and as such it requires the most subtle protection. Without the full functioning of North, Central and South America, the 6th and 7th route races could not come into existence. The divine plan could not continue its unfoldment according to universal law. Inasmuch as the ancient karmic fiat which man brought upon himself, to earn one's bread by the sweat of one's brow, was active under planetary law, it was automatically set aside in recent years when the Earth came under cosmic law. As soon as the knowledge of this liberating change penetrates the consciousness of the people, and they can accept the fact that they are free from the curse of drudgery, then they will desire to draw forth free ray energies to accomplish all things. Therefore, it is obvious that during the Aquarian cycle every person will be required to study the process of precipitation and etherealization. Recently the Seven Elohim, the builders of this planet, have come forth with a dictated book which outlines precise instructions for precipitation. This volume now serves as a textbook for disciples who are studying the process. See suggested reading section. From time to time Saint Germain lowers the vibrations of his subtle bodies so that he may be seen visually, and mingles with groups of disciples. In the United States in recent years he has given actual demonstrations of the precipitation of food, complete with exquisite linens, silver and dishes. He has even made an exception in many cases and retained the linens, silver and dishes in manifestation, presenting them to his dinner guests. It is noteworthy that the linens need never be laundered as no effects of soil cling to them. While the linens appear to be of cloth, and apparently are precipitated as cloth, they are probably charged with fourth ray energies and, therefore, vibrate at such a high frequency that imperfect matter is cast off. This is the ray of purity which Serapis Bey has urged us to use for such practical matters as cleaning our homes, tuning pianos and tuning up motors. It is apparently the ray which is used by space people who visit the Earth and who can walk through dusty deserts, muddy roads, and under rainy skies, and yet appear at the homes of Earth people without a trace of soil on their clothing or shoes. Several contacts have observed and commented on this feat. Although no hint has been given that Tesla and Ascended Master Saint Germain actually met and conferred on the physical plane, there is abundant evidence to indicate that they were in close communication. Nearly all adepts, from Noah down to Saint Germain and Tesla, have been associated with angelic messengers who take embodiment as white doves. This is a subject which is difficult for the Earth mind to understand because we know so little about the angelic kingdom. Angels themselves sometimes take human embodiment in order to perform some special service, but little is known nowadays about these cases. However, we can gain considerable knowledge from the story of Mary, the mother of Jesus. See suggested reading section. She not only belonged to the angelic kingdom, but was originally an archai, or twin flame of Archangel Raphael. She also spent untold centuries in working with the Elohim, assisting in the training of elementals. The Elohim design and build planets, but like all good architects and contractors, they have an army of helpers. These are the little elementals or nature spirits. According to the design made by the Elohim, the little elementals carefully fashion each blade of grass, each flower, each tree, and even each tiny lima bean or apple or orange that we eat. When we say that the little elementals build the fruit and flowers, we mean precisely that. They build out of the substance of their own bodies just as a spider spins a web. After the ascension of Jesus, while Mary was living with the disciples at the old grist mill outside Bethany, she spent considerable time training groups of little elementals. She taught them how to make a certain type of fern among other things. A fern which we still have in abundance today, commonly called maiden's hair. When Mary made her ascension, she returned to her place in the angelic kingdom, but with the added ability to work freely with humans after spending long years among them. Inasmuch as Ascended Master Saint Germain was Joseph in a former embodiment, Mary and her angelic group will play a major role in assisting human beings to orient themselves in New Age activities. It is very easy to contact Mary mentally, and there is always angelic response to every call from a human being. aside from the cases where angels have taken a human embodiment in order to render assistance to humanity, the white doves, which are initiate birds, have served down through centuries of time, as angelic messengers. Angelic entities occupy the bodies of initiate doves in order to get close to the earth and close to human companions, serving them in a thousand subtle ways, radiating forth peace and joy and healing. How often, walking in Central Park, have we felt electrified with sudden joy as a pigeon wheeled through the bright air before us? It is in those moments of flashing splendor that we know the Paraclete is nigh. Like humans, not all doves are graduates or initiates. Many are undergoing discipleship and the majority are just ordinary aspirants to higher initiations. It is from the ranks of disciple doves that carrier pigeons are drawn forth and trained by humans. Also, like humans, doves vary considerably in appearance. Our rock doves and wood doves, which have moved into the big cities of Europe and America, have become known as pigeons. Like so many city folks, with all the comforts of urban living at hand, the pigeons have grown somewhat fat and lazy for the most part, so much so that their brethren in the wilderness would not even recognize them. When Tesla volunteered to take an embodiment on Earth, he did not come to the planet alone. He was accompanied by his twin Ray, an entity so highly evolved that she did not take a human body, but instead manifested through a beautiful white dove. Naturally, living in New York, the dove could not appear too beautiful, or too exceptional, or she would have attracted too much attention. So Tesla's pigeon, as she was called, looked much like any other pigeon and mingled freely with her bird companions in the New York parks. But Tesla knew her well, and could spot her instantly among hundreds of other pigeons. A white female, with a touch of gray in her wings. He used to say, "I would know that pigeon anywhere." Naturally, Tesla never gave the slightest hint as to the actual identity of the bird. In many quarters he was considered just a little overtouched by genius, and his remarks from time to time left his listeners with their heads fairly spinning. Assuredly he had no way to reveal that the white dove, with a touch of gray in her wings, was his twin Ray. It is only in recent years, since Ascended Master Saint Germain began his major activities and connection with the New Age, that even disciples have known a few facts about twin rays. But one of Saint Germain's projects is to bring together the pairs of twin rays in embodiment at the present time, and thus far he has united a considerable number. This is of tremendous value to his Aquarian program, because the average disciple, working alone, accomplishes very little at best. But if a disciple can be reunited with his or her twin ray, the spiritual efficiency of the two, working as a team, is increased about a millionfold. The ray divides into positive and negative white fire beings after the original divine spark leaves the great central sun of the galaxy. That sun is composed of two twin flames, Alpha and Omega. The white fire beings, individualized into positive and negative polarities, are completely free. They also have all the attributes of the Godhead. They are endowed with free will and may do exactly as they wish. They need not leave Alpha and Omega if they wish to remain. On the other hand, they may pursue an evolutionary course if they so desire. Those of us who are here on Earth today are accountable only to ourselves for getting involved in what seems to be a somewhat hazardous ordeal. We were once white fire beings, but we wanted to go out and explore the cosmos, and we were for some reason attracted to this planet. Usually twin rays do not remain together during their evolutionary explorations. Sometimes one remains with Alpha and Omega and one goes forth to wrestle with their world of matter. But at no time are they ever separated so far as their higher presence is concerned. When Tesla volunteered to come to the Earth, his twin Ray, exercising her free will, decided to accompany him, not only because it would be more pleasant for them to be together, but because her presence would enormously increase his efficiency in the job he had to do. She wished to remain in the background, however, so she chose to manifest as a white dove. She was always somewhere fairly near Tesla, and they were in telepathic communication. Frequently, she flew into the open window of his hotel room at night and they would have long talks together. But she was an advanced initiate in her own right, and made herself as useful as possible in service to the light. Between 25 and 30 years ago in the United States, Saint Germain arranged for the reunion of several pairs of twin rays. At that time he frequently used a white dove as a messenger, and although this may not have been Tesla's dove, still it serves as an example of the type of work that she would do for the hierarchy. If Saint Germain wished to send a message to a disciple who was not telepathic, he would write the message on a small white card and have it delivered by a dove. In these cases the doves are always initiates, they are completely intelligent and never make a mistake. The dove, card in beak, would tap at a window or otherwise call attention to his presence. Upon admittance, he would deliver the card, pause for a loving caress, and then fly away. After the message on the card had been noted by the recipient, the card would vanish into thin air. In other words, after the purpose had been served in physical matter, the imprisoned energy was released and returned to universal supply. Page 147. Reference has already been made to imprisoned energy, which is so weakened by its long and brutal confinement in matter that it must, when transmuted and released by action of the violet fire, be sent back to the sun for recharging. This burden of imprisoned energy constitutes man's karmic burden today. A great part of this confined energy is stored away in attics, cellars, old buildings, slums, abandoned debris, junkyards, crowded clothes closets, the bottom drawer of the dresser, and especially in cemeteries where burial has replaced the clean, swift, releasing process of cremation. Man will never have access to universal supply until he learns to get rid of junk. Not for the sake of getting rid of it, but with the specific mental injunction that it is to be returned to universal supply. Then he must get rid of his magpie-like tendency to hoard, hoard, hoard. The person who hoards does not have faith and trust in God, no matter what he may say to the contrary. Some of the greatest hoarders, and therefore, some of those who trust God the least, are often found up in the pulpit telling other people how to live. Persons like Mary and Saint Germain and Jesus set the correct example. Mary wished to leave the planet richer and more beautiful, even on the physical plane. So she precipitated the design for maidenhair fern and taught the elementals how to build it. Saint Germain lowers his vibration so that he is visible to the ordinary human eye, and then demonstrates to his disciples how to precipitate food, dishes, linens and silver. Jesus, during his last embodiment, also precipitated food in a similar lesson for the benefit of his disciples. He supplied enough precipitated loaves and fishes, or what appeared to be genuine earth food, to feed 5,000 hungry and weary people who had been good enough to give their attention to his discourse. Then, remember that he instructed his disciples to secure baskets and gather up the fragments of the food lest they be lost. In other words, he was obligated to etherealize the leftovers and return them to universal supply. Later, at the wedding feast of Cana, Jesus demonstrated another form of supply through qualification. For 2,000 years the scriptural account of changing water into wine has seemed to be a somewhat useless piece of information. Now we have vital need of this account in order to better understand how and why the space people qualify substance, and how we can qualify all things by thought, molding them to meet our desire. A thought is a thing. The scriptural story tells how Jesus commanded that the wine jars be filled with water. Then in a simple silent ceremony he transmuted the water into electronic substance with a high frequency, ridding it of all impurities or qualifications. When the purified and unqualified water was poured into the wine glasses, the assembled guests naturally thought they were to taste a delicious wine. They had been drinking wine and expected to drink more wine. They fully qualified the water with their own thoughts. When they drank the water they declared it to be the finest wine they had ever tasted. Thoughts are things and, in this case, the thing was transmuted water qualified to take like wine. When Van Tassel was offered tiny cubes of substance by the space people he was told to qualify the cubes before eating them. He did so and enjoyed a meal of his favorite foods. This bit of white magic was identical with that demonstrated at the wedding feast of Cana. Those demonstrations also lead us to an understanding of the One. The One is actually the universal sum total of unqualified energy. The One is no thing. The instant the energy is qualified, its vibratory action is lowered and it becomes something. When Jesus raised the vibration of the water in the wine jars, it became no thing. When qualified by the thoughts of the wedding guests, the vibratory action was lowered in conformity, and it became something which tasted like wine.